Join me, Dr. Kathy Weston, for my podcast series, Get a Grip, brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. In each podcast, I help unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? How can we make sure our children engage safely with the digital world? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main researchers in this area and asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip.
Welcome back to part two of the interview between Maggie Johnson and Hope Christie on selective mutism.
You mentioned there Yumwa, who you worked with on the book, and I did see in her personal preface for the book, she talks about her own daughter and how she noticed that at three she was talking less and less, and then by the time her daughter reached five she wasn't speaking in public at all, which was really striking to read, and obviously a really lovely experience to bring into the book to talk about, because I think it's always nice to kind of feel like you're being heard or seen as a parent when you're reading something like that. So it was really lovely to read that from her. But in terms of that, other warning signs then, so to speak, kind of at that preschool age almost, that parents can maybe look out for, because obviously Yumwa talked about the child talking less and less, and then by five, you know, 2 years later, not speaking at all. So could you speak to some of the warning signs that parents can look out for?
Well, of course, that is the main one, not talking. Yeah. But, you know, it's this contrast between being able to talk fine in some situations. So at five, this little girl could still speak absolutely fine at home. She was a regular little chatterbox at home. But then just nothing walking down the street or going into shops, just nothing in public. It's that contrast that characterises selective mutism. And, you know, and the older the child gets and the brighter the child is, you know, the more aware they are of the types of situation that could possibly lead to an expectation to speak to someone outside your comfort zone. And I think Yunhua's daughter was particularly bright, and she very quickly worked out, it's when I'm out with mummy, I might get this horrid feeling, and if people see me talk, they might just come over and talk to me as well, and she just shut down. But yeah, other warning signs. What you might also notice is an almost eerie silence when other people are around, and this might be in your own home. This is not about going out in public. Mm-hmm. Children might play with their toys completely silently. They're just not making the little noises that they would make, you know, wee, brum, brum,
yeah, yeah.
You know, crashing, making sound, you know. There's nothing, not a sound is coming from them. Or they might not make a single sound when they hurt themselves. So they'll still come up to you, you know, nursing a cut knee or something, but you know that normally they'd be wailing. And now, somehow, they're not making a noise. So I think that is very striking. You don't get that with anything apart from selective mutism. It's only when there's someone else around that you are worried that if they see you talking to your parent, you'll be expected to talk to them too.
Wow.
I've already mentioned how alert these children are and how they can stop talking almost mid-flow when other people appear. So that's another classic SM warning sign. And something we haven't mentioned, but this is another giveaway because you just don't see it with anything else apart from selective mutism. And that is when a child is happy to use non-verbal communication, like just nodding or shaking their head or pointing to something. They're happy to use that with some people, but with other people, they completely withdraw any form of communication. And it will all be down to the people involved and the way that person is reacting to the child. If people don't ask the child lots of questions or try to get the child to talk, so they just get down on their hands and knees and are happy to do all the talking, and they talk about what they're playing with and they make up a lovely game and, oh, look, he's going into there and this one's going there. And they don't do this thing of asking the child questions and waiting for an answer. Well, the child is going to relax around them. and they will feel safe to use gesture with them. And gesture is always the starting point of entering into conversation. So the child will relax with people like that and they'll feel safe to use gesture. And gesture is the first starting point of communicating with a new person. You just start to nod or shake your head and you feel safe if they don't immediately come back at you by saying, "What did you say? Sorry, I can't hear you." Or "We don't point here. You tell me what you want." You know, if someone just accepts that you use gesture and they're still happy to carry on doing all the talking, that child will gradually talk to you because the expectation is gone. They're not setting off the fight, flight, freeze response. Mm-hmm. But if the child is with a person who asks questions or makes it obvious they're waiting for an answer, they expect the child to say please or thank you or hello, that child isn't even going to use any nonverbal communication with them because they see this person as someone who is not safe to talk to. I keep using the word safe, but if you have a phobia, yeah, that's how it affects you. You yep. just have this feeling, it's not safe, I can't do this, I mustn't do this, you know, escape.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Maggie. I think you've started to answer this question, which is brilliant, in terms of what advice would you have for parents if they start to see these warning signs in children? Should they seek professional help right away? Or are there things they can maybe do at home in the first instance? What would be your advice there?
Well, you definitely need to do something straight away, because we know that the sooner you intervene, the sooner these children get over their SM. It's always worth finding out what help is available from your local speech and language therapy or your local psychology or mental health service for children who have selective mutism. But depending where you live, seeking professional help might even slow things down. So I think the main thing is to get the right information about how to support your child at home and at school and other community settings and just start acting on it immediately. If it is selective mutism and your hunch is right, then the strategies are going to start working immediately. And mm-hmm. if it's not SM, you won't be doing the child any harm because all you're saying is, let's help the child talk when they're ready. Let's make sure they talk at their own pace, that they're not feeling rushed or forced. And I think we all appreciate that. So look, if you're lucky, you will get the information you need quickly from the professionals you approach. And they might be able to provide information sessions online so that there's no waiting list. That's what we do in Kent. If you're not so lucky, well, you can get all the information you need from the workbook. So I'm really grateful to you for, you know, giving me this chance to talk about it, because I do know that so many families just aren't lucky enough to have the service that we have here. Mm-hmm. So look, ideally, I'd say go for a two-pronged attack. Seek professional help. You may need to see a professional for other reasons too. You know, the child might have an additional speech and language difficulty, which is quite different to the SM. They might have additional problems with reading, perhaps, or even suspected autism. So, you know, it may well be that you do need professional help for whatever reason. Get the process underway with a referral, but I'd say get started on simple home strategies for the selective mutism while you're waiting to be seen. Don't wait weeks or possibly months for confirmation of a diagnosis. It just isn't worth it. As I say, these strategies are not going to hurt any child.
Yeah, that's a really lovely message, actually, that like just it's not going to harm them. Do you know, like you say, you're just getting them ready to talk when they're ready, even if it turns out not to be SM. Sure. I think that's such a great message that actually you're not going to do any harm by implementing those strategies anyway. Lovely. Thanks, Maggie. And when I was looking through some of the example worksheets in your workbook, I really loved the top three goals on one of the example worksheets I seen for parents was to educate themselves, educate others and their child about SM. And coming from, I know I've already said, but coming from my background in trauma and PTSD, psychoeducation is so helpful for parents that I've worked with, and I'm sure obviously you agree because it's the top three tasks in the worksheet to psychoeducate. Do you have anything you'd like to say about that?
Well, no, I do. I completely agree. And these are actually three separate worksheets that give parents the tools they need to educate themselves, educate others. That might be your relatives, or it might be members of staff. And so importantly, to start talking to their child about what they're going through. And honestly, that was a turning point for me. As soon as I realised SM was a phobia, and it took me years to work that out, but as soon as I realised it was a phobia, I started talking to the children openly about it. And what's more, I insisted that the parents did too. Mm-hmm. And until then, I don't think any of us had understood it properly. So we didn't know what to say to the child. And very often parents or teachers, they didn't want to talk about it in case they made things worse for the child. Mm. So yeah, this has been a big turning point.
Excellent. And can you possibly point to some resources that parents can maybe talk through with their children to help them understand SM? I'm thinking maybe especially younger children who maybe aren't quite at a reading age or things, so parents might struggle to explain it at like an age appropriate level. Mm. Is there any resources you can maybe point to for those things?
Well, I think the main resource are just having the right words. Mm-hmm. And knowing the sorts of situations that you're in when this is a good time to talk about it with the child. I think a really useful thing with young children is if you can link it to another anxiety mm-hmm. that they've had. So you can just be saying things to children, I know you're really worried about talking. The most important thing is to stop asking children why they're not talking. Children have got no idea why. Mm-hmm. They haven't a clue why. They just know they can't, and it's horrible. And the minute you ask them, why aren't you talking, it feels rather critical. It's like, why do you keep hitting your brother, or why don't you tidy your bedroom?
Mm-hmm, so
it's just about having the right words, and the workbook is just full of the right phrases to use. So you don't ask them why, you just acknowledge it. I know you're really worried about talking. Mm-hmm. I know you're finding it hard to talk to granddad at the moment. You know, it's not always going to be like that. It will get easier for you. It's like when you were too scared to go down the slide. Do you remember those photos we've got of you when you were a baby or a toddler? You were sitting at the top of that slide, clinging on and crying because you didn't dare let go. You were too scared to go down. You just couldn't move. You were frozen. You couldn't do it, you know? And it's the same with talking. At the moment, it feels too scary to talk, but you can go down the slide now, can't you? You go down the big chute at the swimming pool. You're brilliant at it. And that's because we helped you and you just gradually did it in tiny little steps. You just practiced it a bit at a time, you know, and that's what it's going to be with talking. You will be able to talk, but you haven't got to rush it, just a tiny bit at a time. Granddad doesn't mind waiting. He just wants to have fun and have a good time with you. He knows you'll talk when you're ready. So with a lot of young children, all you need to say is, hey, don't worry. If you feel too scared, I'm thinking about with younger children, I wouldn't even talk about, you know, using emotional words. Mm-hmm. I would just say, don't worry. You don't have to talk to granddad. If you don't feel like it, wait till you feel better about talking. He won't mind. Mm-hmm. So it's just treating it in a very practical way. And the big advice I give is if your child was, you know, scared of jumping in the swimming pool or scared of dogs, you talk to them about it.
Yep.
So that's the big message. So you as a parent are your child's main resource. But of course, there are lovely books that if you want a bit of help, you know, finding the right words, or you want to show children, they're not the only one. Look, it's a book in the library all about it or whatever. There are lots of books, like Alison and I also did it's a tiny little book called Can I Tell You About Selective Mutism?
Yeah.
And it's a child talking and telling her parents and her friends and relatives and teachers what it's like. And she's telling them what they can do to help. So that's a lovely book that you can read to children. There's a book called My Friend Daniel Has Selective Mutism, and that helps the child see that lots of children have this, but in the end, they get there. And you can also read that book to their friends, and the friends then know how they can support the child. There's so many books. We've got a list in the workbook. What else have we got? We've got My Name is Ben and I Don't Talk Sometimes. And there's Maya's Voice. and can't talk, won't talk. And a lot of these books have got lovely illustrations in. So yes, it's actually quite easy to do a Google and find books that you can share.
Excellent.
Child, you know. With older children, you can just explain it's a phobia. And it's usually such a relief to children to know that there's an explanation, you know, for what's happening to them and there's a name for it.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think such a brilliant, empowering message that you've said there, that the parents are the resource. Because I think that sometimes parents can feel a bit, like you say, they're maybe worried they're making it worse or they're not doing enough or they should be helping their child in another way. So yeah, thank you for saying that. It's such a lovely, empowering message for parents to hear. And I'm sure you've probably come across it in your own practice when parents are maybe encouraging family members, relatives, other friends to understand a little bit more about SM, and maybe they meet a little bit of resistance along the way in terms of maybe people saying, oh, we'll just make the child talk, or like you say, those unhelpful strategies of asking them why they're not talking, or it's a choice and they're not doing it for whatever reasons, those kind of misunderstandings that we've addressed. So what would be your advice to help parents navigate those people in their lives that are maybe a bit more resistant to the idea the child has SM?
Well, again, I just say to parents, hang on to the fact that this is a phobia and think mm-hmm. about how you talk to relatives and so on about that. You know, if your child's got a phobia of dogs, you're going to say to granddad, look, we're not going to come round unless you keep Shep tied up. Yeah. You know, and you're not going to take no for an answer. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's very important to explain, look, I know it's hard to understand, but this is a phobia. To talk very positively, you know, my child, he's doing really well. He's doing really well. We're supporting him to work through it. And we'd love you to be part of that. We need you to be part of that process. So what would really help him, you know, is if you could, you know, show him that talking is not the main thing. You just want to have fun. You want to play games. We really would love you to be part of that. But look, in the end, it is up to you. If you don't want to help, then we'll stop visiting and we'll find other ways to stay in touch, because I can't put my child through this. He is dying inside when you try to make him say hello. And he loves you. He loves you. He doesn't want to let you down. We're not saying we don't want to stay in touch, but we need to do it the right way, you know. And then you just give them some literature to digest, and there's, you know, all sort. You can download stuff from the NHS website, you know, NHS Choices. That's got a whole little section on selective mutism. You can download information from there. You know, it doesn't have to be the workbook, but there's information there. You can join SMIRA. That's the UK national charity for children and families and young people living with selective mutism. You know, get your hand on some literature and leave it with those people to digest, but just stick to your guns. But let them know you need their help, and obviously you don't want to fall out over it, you know. But I think just remember how adamant you would be if you knew this was a phobia. You would not let anybody terrorize your child knowing that it was causing them distress. And then there's another tack you can take, actually, and I've done this. I've often met parents where the two parents are not in agreement with each other. So you've got mm-hmm. one of them totally sympathetic and buying into the fact it's a phobia, the other one totally disagreeing and thinks, no, yeah. you need to make them buck up and, you know, mm-hmm. yeah. So what I've done there, and I don't see any reason why parents can't do this with their relatives as well, I've acknowledged completely that they don't agree with me. And I say, and I understand that you've got your reasons for that. But I will ask them to try it my way for just 2 weeks. I might even say, so what do you think would work? Have you been trying that? Is it helping? And they'll always say, well, no, not yet. And I'll say, okay, well, look, please, I'm asking you a big favour. Can we just try it my way for 2 weeks, no more. That's all I'm saying, 2 weeks, because the strategies do work within 2 weeks. You start yeah. seeing a change. But I never disagree with somebody and say, you're wrong. You know, if you want someone on your side, you've got to show that you're trying to see it from their point of view as well. So I will be saying things like, I do understand why you see it like that. That's exactly how it looks, isn't it? It looks like the child is trying to control the situation. It looks as if they're manipulating things, but actually, you know, all they're doing is trying to control their own anxiety. Now, imagine if you had a phobia, you would want to be in control of what was happening to make sure you didn't get, you know, shut in a small room or shut in a lift. You'd make sure you took the stairs. You'd make sure you kept away from people who you thought were going to put you in a situation. So we all need to be in control of her own anxiety. And that is how I would see it, that she is trying to keep things under control for her own well-being. She's not trying to control you. She just needs to control her own anxiety.
Excellent. Thank you. No, that's really lovely. And I think I'm sure there's probably families that can relate to that. So lovely that you've given that advice. Thank you so much. And if we shift over to from a teacher's perspective, thinking about what advice you might be able to give them to support a child with SM in the classroom. And I'm sure a lot of that will be found in the workbook, but anything else that you could give us just now?
Sure. Well, the basic advice is going to be exactly the same advice you give granddad, you know, or, yeah, you know, whoever, which is going to be about, don't ask direct questions to start with. You just do all the talking and you adopt this kind of commentary style talk where you say it's fine to greet the child, say hello, show them what's going on, explain what they have to do, explain the rules of a game, make comments yourself, tell them about your day rather than asking them how their day went and so on. Have fun. Accept the child as they are and enjoy all their other talents and skills. You know, we've got to kind of lose this focus of the only thing that matters is they talk. No, that's not the only thing. You know, let's just enjoy them as people. It's really important to accept other forms of communication. And, you know, so they might send granddad a birthday card where they've recorded a message, happy birthday, granddad. You know, they might write a letter and they might nod, shake the head and point. And so in school, it's particularly important that teachers are willing to accept other forms of communication to start with, because these are the stepping stones to verbal communication. And accepting other forms of communication is really important for inclusion, because it means that the child can still take part in responding to the register and taking part at circle time. We don't want to just leave them out. Children end up feeling like they've been sent to Coventry if they get left out of things. Mm-hmm. But try to find a way of taking the register where the child can easily participate. So, for example, you don't say, Danny, Jade, Maisie, you know, and expect the child to answer, but you ask the whole class, is Danny here? Have a look, everybody. Is Danny here? And the whole class calls out, yes, miss.
Yeah.
Is Maisie here? So there's such simple things you can do. Or you say to the whole class, now I need to know if you're here. I'm going to call your name out. And when you hear your name, I want you to either say, yes, miss, or good morning, miss, or put your hand up. You decide.
Yeah, yeah. So you're bringing in that non-verbal mode of communication, yeah, as well. Yeah.
Exactly. And you can do the same thing with circle time. Children don't have to tell their news. You know, they could bring in a drawing that they've done, or they could bring in a clue and let the other children guess what they did. You know, they bring in a cinema ticket or a Happy Meal bag. Well, maybe that's a bit of a big clue, but you know what I mean? There's yeah, lots of other things you can do where the child is still fully included. And there, I can't stress enough that what is most important to, you know, if we're an anxious person, what boosts us in all ways is feeling friendship and support and feeling valued. And it just has this, it builds our confidence, and that then has a ripple effect and makes us feel much less anxious about things in generally. Yeah, voice recordings. I mentioned that with, you know, sending granddad a birthday card. Well, yeah, you can incorporate voice recordings into school so easily, and talking openly about it. You can say to child, I know you're finding talking difficult at the moment. Now, look, I don't want you to worry, because lots of children have that, but they do all start talking when they're ready. So I know, why don't you record your news at home? And then you can just play that so you don't, you will be part of circle time. Or lots of these children are good at reading, and so you can say, you can do your reading at home with mummy, bring in a recording and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, there are so many other ways, but obviously we don't just want to make it so that they don't have to talk. This is not about avoiding talking. It's about, this is a stepping stone to talking. So the main thing is, you're going to build rapport with the child by showing that you understand and you are happy to wait for when they're ready. But then what we do is we nudge them on to the next step by using one of the strategies in the workbook is called graded questioning. So as we see the child relax, and they really will start to relax, and they will start using nonverbal communication when they don't feel under pressure, you now do start moving on to questions. And the first question you would always ask is a choice question. So who would you like to sit with today, Jimmy or Mina? Just give them a choice, one or the other. You know, that kind of choice, that's going to be the easiest way for a child to get that first word out. I do the same thing with teenagers or adults that I meet.
Yeah.
The actual first question I ask, if I meet, I can remember meeting an adult off the train in Canterbury. We were going to the group for adults that we were running at the time. And, you know, the very first question I would have asked, apart from questions that where she could just nod or shake her head, I can't remember, you know, but it was definitely something about the journey she's had. So did you get on at Faversham or Whitstable? And she answered. It's just so, because you're just copying one word that someone has said. So just knowing that graded question sequence, don't go in with these big open-ended questions like, so what did you think about that? And what did you get up to at the weekend? These are the sort of typical questions people ask, which actually push you right into having to use several sentences at once if you're going to answer properly. So yeah, that's really important. And the final thing I will say is, it's really important to remember that these children can't initiate. That's kind of last with selective mutism. A lot of children do manage to respond a tiny bit. They can answer simple factual questions with one or two words, but the situation they just cannot manage is when you've got to start a conversation off. You've got to initiate it. Now, this makes them vulnerable because they can't ask for help. They can't report an incident. They can't let you know how they're feeling. So we've got to remember, they are not going to be able to initiate. So we need to remember to check that they've understood. You know, just go up to them and have a quiet word with them. Was there anything there you need me to go over again? Have you understood? Because the child is not going to put their hand up in class initially to ask a question. They're going to work towards it. I expect them to get there gradually, but to start with, you need to initiate those conversations, check that they're okay, make sure they've got a friend to sit with. Don't leave them to find a partner or be the last to be chosen. You know, pair the vulnerable children up and then let the rest of the class find a partner themselves. And, you know, this whole thing about they can't initiate, it's really important to maintain good dialogue with home. Have a two-way communication system, either a book or an email system. Because if there are any problems, the child will be telling their parents, and we need to be ready at school to listen to the parents and not think that this is a parent who is, you know, always worrying about something. This child would normally at school be able to let an adult know if something was wrong, if somebody was being unkind to them or taking their dinner money from them or whatever it is. They'd be able to report that. But if you've got SM, you can't. And even nonverbal initiation is terribly difficult, because then you're worried that someone will come up to you and ask you questions about it anyway, you know. So you really are quite vulnerable. And so this really open two-way dialogue between home and school, where you're just saying, this is so that the child will have a voice. You know, the child is actually going to be able to talk to you, but via their parents. It's not forever. I always say this is a short-term solution until the child can talk to and initiate conversation with at least one adult at school. Yeah. And sitting them with their friends and setting up those play dates at home, that's so important. Teachers often separate children from their friends, thinking that that friend is talking for the child. But we have to remember, these, you know, just separating the children isn't going to make the child with SM speak. You know, they've now lost that one person who they could talk to, maybe. And if the child can therefore talk to a friend and initiate conversation in that way, there's lots of little strategies where we actually use that friend that they're sitting with as a go-between. You know, that's the important thing. Use their friends to your advantage rather than just separate children from their talking friends and hope that that will somehow spur the child on to speak for themselves.
Lovely. Thank you. And I know we just kind of touched on it again there when you were talking about initiating, and you can't expect the child to do that right away. And for some of the activities that you outlined in your manual about the child needing to initiate and that they might find that quite difficult, in terms of a classroom setting, is there any impacts of SM on learning, or is it more with those kind of initiating tasks or engaging that impacts more?
Well, it doesn't need to impact on learning at all. Many children with SM, they do really well at school, I would say, despite their SM, you know, because a lot of children who have SM are very able and they find ways around it. So it doesn't have to impact on learning, but it certainly can. And so a lot of it is just this kind of practical thing that they can't ask for help. And that can then upset the child. They really want to get on with their maths or all their homework, but they haven't been able to ask for clarification. And so, you know, they're getting distressed by it, and they know they feel they're not performing as well as they could. And so often these children appear to be doing fine, but I would say if they didn't have SM, they could be doing even better. You know?
Yeah.
But I would say there is a big emotional impact on children, and that is in the end what is going to impact their learning more than anything else. If their SM is not being handled well, then they could be sitting there just too stressed to listen well, too anxious to absorb anything properly, because what they're actually doing is sitting there dreading being asked a question. They'll see that the teacher is picking other children to answer a question. Or they're choosing children to come and read their work out in front of the class. And if the teacher hasn't reassured that child that, don't worry, I'm not going to do that until you find talking easier, if you've not had that reassurance, you can just spend the whole day on tenterhooks.
Yeah, just waiting.
And
yeah.
You know what? That dog phobia analogy is brilliant here, because it's like knowing there's a dog on the loose in the school. And you're being sent to school every day, but you are just walking around never knowing when that dog is, he might run down the corridor or burst into your classroom. You know, you're not going to want to go there. Do you know what? I feel tense in my stomach, actually, just thinking about it. I was very nervous about dogs when I was a child, and that feeling just came back then. So, yeah, there's this emotional side that you're just too anxious to absorb it all. And the other thing is, you could just be too uncomfortable. You might need the toilet, but you can't ask. So, again, we know if you are worried about you need the toilet, you're not concentrating on what the person talking to you is saying, you know. And the other awful thing is that often these children stop eating and drinking in order to not need to go to the toilet. And so potentially you've got children who are too hungry or too thirsty or too tired because of all of this to concentrate. All of it is preventable, you know, with some simple strategies. But there really can be a big impact, you know, on learning if we don't handle it right.
Yeah, thank you. No, those are really helpful examples and things for teachers to be mindful of, and also parents. And I really like that suggestion of having that go between parents and teachers so that you can keep a track on everything. And I think probably it'll be similar to how you've talked about dealing with relatives or other family members, but how might teachers deal with maybe unhelpful comments from peers in the class who maybe don't understand or might possibly make fun of a child with SM?
Well, yeah, I think you do need to talk openly to peers as well. And I think the best thing is to have a quick response ready. Mm-hmm. You know, I think all teachers, it's either happened to them already or they can anticipate the kind of things that other children might say. So have a quick response ready. And it will be things like, you know, there might be a substitute teacher come in and it's really important we give them, you know, a quick sort of thumbnail about this child.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a child might say, oh, don't ask Jade, she can't talk. Or why can't Jade talk? They're asking you, that sort of thing. So just simple responses. And you can say this in front of Jade, you know, mm-hmm. saying, of course Jade can talk. Jade talks beautifully at home, don't you, Jade? And Jade is going to talk at school too when she's ready.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can just talk openly about it. I heard one teacher, I was actually observing this, and one teacher was brilliant because this actually happened while I was observing this kind of story time. And I did think, oh my goodness, what's the teacher going to do? She was amazing. She did say, of course, Jade can talk, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But then she said, and now, if you're lucky, you might be the first child that Jade talks to at school. But if you carry on like that, I don't think it'll be you. And it was so funny. And even the little girl Jade laughed at that point.
Aww.
And Jade just loved the fact that the teacher had turned it round on the child.
On the child.
So, yes, just saying things like, Jade will talk. She'll talk when she's ready. But for now, Jade is enjoying listening and thinking. And that's really helpful too, you know. So having those sort of responses ready, that is really important. So that you can just deal with these kind of one-off comments on an ad hoc basis. But
sure.
Sometimes you do need to sit and talk to the whole class.
Mm-hmm.
And this is always triggered by the child's needs. It will be the child who is saying something like, oh, why do they keep doing this? Why do they keep asking me to talk? They keep trying to make me talk. I hate it. So you kind of find out via parents that the child is very unhappy with what's going on at school. At that point, you just need to get the children together and have a little chat and just make it clear that we all find things difficult, you know, and for some children, it's talking that is difficult to start talking in a new place. But there's lots of things we can do to help, and I need you to be my best helpers. And then just sort of thinking about ways that we can support the child. The other reason that you might need to talk to the whole class is when the child is actually making lots of progress. They're talking to the teacher now. They may be talking to their classroom assistant now. They're talking to a couple of friends. But they are actually saying, but I can't talk in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're worried of all the questions. They might have known the other children for, you know, a couple of years now. And if they suddenly start talking, it's going to generate all sorts of questions. What are the other children going to think if I start talking now? It's that sort of thing. Or one child said, they'll think I was lying if I start talking now. You know, that child was autistic, funnily. Isn't that enough? Isn't it?
Oh, it's bless.
Her very black and white view of
yeah.
things. Mm-hmm. But I could see what she meant. So I just said, right. Don't worry, I'm going to talk to all the other children, or I'll get your teacher to talk to the other children about this, and we'll make sure they understand. They won't think you're lying. They'll be really happy for you that you've made such good progress. They'll be proud yeah. of you, you know, and we'll let them know that you're ready to start talking, and we'll make sure that, you know, they just talk to you like any of the other children and don't make a fuss about it. They treat you just the same as anybody else, okay? And that they don't ask lots of questions, because they'll be ready. They won't be surprised, because we'll let them know that you're going to talk soon. And the children actually welcome this. And we let the children choose whether they're going to be in the class. And I remember one six-year-old, she was so pleased that the teacher was going to talk. She wanted to be in there, because she, in her mind, the teacher was going to tell all the other children off, which was lovely. It was just her personality. But a lot of children, they choose to wait outside. But the words are agreed, you know, they always know what the teacher is going to say, you know.
Yeah.
It's very important to keep the child involved.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you. Okay, so I think I'll ask you two final questions, one of which is about the new book that you've got coming out. It talks about personal experiences and success stories. And I wondered if you maybe just had an example that you could share from the book or from your own experience about a success story and how helpful that's been for other parents.
Sure. In fact, I was talking to a group of parents in Norway last week, and I did pick a couple of examples from the manual. And parents always do feel inspired, you know, when they see it is possible to overcome this. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you two quick examples. One was a little boy, Noah, who his parents came to our speech therapy department when he was about, you know, 4.5. And nobody else would believe her that this little boy was just, you know, an outgoing, chatty child at home. They thought he'd also got a diagnosis of autism, so they just felt, no, mum is just seeing this the way she wants to.
Mm.
But when she came to the speech therapy department, we never doubted her. We felt it completely fitted the pattern of selective mutism. And that little boy, by the age of 6, was over his selective mutism, partly because of his wonderful family who just loved all the strategies. They incorporated them beautifully into their day-to-day life. The Zoom was a very powerful thing for them over the pandemic, really helped. And after that, he then did speak at school. But they did also change school. I never recommend that people do this. But if you really feel that you're hitting your head against a brick wall, they actually decided to start afresh with a new school. And the school were wonderful and just accepting. So with no actual specialist intervention in terms of working with the child, because he never wore a speech and language therapist, what we did as specialists was give the parents the advice they needed. And the school came on our training program as well. And if you Google Kent selective mutism, anyone can access that training video, you know. Just with these informal strategies, that little boy was fine. And then the other example again, because this boy was Norwegian, he was 16 and he'd been written off by the services in Norway. This damning report had been written by a psychologist saying that he would never function independently. And he'd been in therapy for a couple of years and made no progress. And it was felt that he was just being very, very stubborn and determined not to speak. And somehow, thank goodness, his mum came across our manual, the Selective Mutism Resource Manual, and she came to London to come on one of our training courses. And she went back and she just used our techniques at home. Within a week, he was talking to his grandmother. Within 2 weeks, he was talking to both of his grandparents. They changed school. They found a really amazing school. Within 18 months, he was totally fine. And then his mother actually, I didn't realize, she was actually attending the conference that I was speaking at, but she was attending it online. And she then just wrote in the chat, "I am Sander's mother. Let me tell you, he is an absolute master student now. He is doing so well."
Oh.
And it just shows that you just need the information. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
And I honestly, my heart goes out to both of these mothers who actually had to work really hard to get the right help.
Mm-hmm.
But once they found it, they were rewarded in loads, you know, just
what a difference.
Children. Yeah, it's great.
Brilliant. And I'm sure you probably had enough of projects now because you finished the book and you said it was quite a challenge, but a rewarding one. But are there any other exciting projects that you're working on right now that our listeners might be interested in?
Well, I just want to take this knowledge further afield. And so, yes, I have just started on. I'm working very closely with the people in China, obviously. And what we're doing is I work with Course Beetle.
Mm-hmm.
They do all the training events for me. It's mainly on Zoom. So what I am doing is developing a very interactive training module that can be carried out online with lots of little self-checks to check your learning as you go and so on. It's got videos in and all sorts. But the idea is that we're going to build it in such a way that it can very easily be translated into Chinese. And then once that's available, we'll be able to translate it into any other language as well. And I think that will mean I can actually relax myself. I mean, I was supposed to retire from the NHS a couple of years ago, but I'm fine. And I have officially retired from the NHS, but I haven't stopped working. And I need a way that I can't get round all these other countries that need the help. I can't meet the training need. So this is my plan, that I can actually stop and actually enjoy my grandchildren. That's my main project in life, you know. But if I can kind of get the information out there in any language, oh, that would just be an absolute dream for me. What I really want is that people don't need me anymore, and because they've got the help there on their doorstep. That would just be wonderful.
Amazing. Well, Maggie, thank you so much for your time. It's been fantastic to speak to you about selective mutism and to hear all about it and about your new book coming out, which we will link to on our website when the podcast goes up. So thanks so much for your time, Maggie. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
This Get a Grip podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.